Hey, Brian.
Hey, Elliot.
What's the talk of the table?
Today, we are sitting down with Joshua Fox, one half of the duo behind Lovecraft Desk, Second Edition. Josh, welcome to the table.
Welcome.
Hello. Thank you.
Thanks so much for being here. So excited to have you here.
So, Josh, we're excited today to talk to you kind of centrally about Lovecraft-esque, specifically the second edition that recently came out. We want to deep dive into, you know, the vibes and the mechanics, talk a bit about emergent mystery and how that plays into the game. But we specifically want to kind of center the conversation around this journey that this game has taken from 1E to 2E and how you and Becky have thought about the game throughout that process. So before we get to this big, exciting, delicious box set that is 2E, could you tell us what Lovecraft-esque 1E looked like when it came out?
Yeah, so Lovecraft-esque was our first major game, and it was a 200-page A5 softcover that we made on POD, really kind of slimline indie-style game where you would build a story in the mold of a kind of pulp eldritch tales such as H.P. Lovecraft might write, but shorn of all the kind of racism and other dreadful stuff that tends to come with such stories when they're done in role-playing form in particular. And the whole conceit of the game is that you build that story from scratch at the table without anybody having done any planning, without a GM, and with nobody at the table knowing where the mystery is going or where it's going to end up until the very end.
Along that journey from going from first edition to second edition, because first edition, as you said, was a book. Second edition is a big box set full of cards and a number of other things. What was it about first edition that made you want to revamp the presentation of the game for second edition? And also, like, what were the changes within the game that happened between 1 and 2E?
Yeah, so it's kind of, actually, this is kind of what we wanted to do in the first place. But, we made the game back in, the first edition of the game back in 2015. And it was pretty scary. I mean, like, in many ways, it was a golden age. It still is a golden age in terms of having the levers at your disposal to go from having nothing to creating a game without taking major risks. But it felt like a big risk. It felt like, oh, this thing could easily fail. We might get no money at all. And when we looked at producing a board game, the risks were like an order of magnitude greater. It's more money, more challenges, and we didn't know what we were doing around that, bluntly. It just seemed so much easier to put everything in a book, and it was a more conventional indie game, I guess, in that respect. So we did produce a set of cards to go with it because drive-through cards existed, so we could create them POD, again, kind of risk-free. But we tried to keep them as an optional part of the game because we were afraid that people would be frightened of cards. But as time has gone on, we've got more confident, we've got more experience, and we've seen things like, you know, Fiasco Second Edition come out, Dialect, you know, lots of great card-based TTRPGs coming out, and it felt like a thing that we could do. And the rise of relatively cheap, accessible manufacturing of board games made it feel more realistic for us to do it. So this is kind of what we wanted to do all along. And the reason being that, like, those cards, what they do, if you imagine, so the first edition, the thing about the first edition was it effectively said to you in each scene, make up a scary clue, right? I don't think that's that hard. Most people can do that, but it is a bit of a kind of just draw me a picture. Here's a blank piece of paper, away you go. Right. Type of challenge.
No lines, just do it yourself.
Yeah, exactly. So if you kind of know horror and you know eldritch horror, it's no problem. But the cards bridge the gap between that prompt and something fully fleshed out. They say to you, here is an idea. You know, you get a handful of ideas, basically, that you can grab and run with. And I think that improves the game massively, personally.
I love that you pointed out Fiasco, because that was also like a parallel I was drawing between the book version of Fiasco and then the card game version, or the like box set version. And then the other one I'm thinking of between, you know, published between 2015 and now, that's I would imagine has a big influence, maybe not necessarily on the game, but all just on the familiarity role players are with like a card-based system is for the Queen and all the games that it has spawned. Like that's become more of a common thing rather than something that is like that is strange in a way that might put you off. Now it's strange in a way that excites you or is interesting in a way that excites you because it has a legacy to it as well.
Yeah, completely agree. And yeah, I guess that's probably one of the most popular games of the last, I don't know quite when it came out actually, but it definitely feels like that's so recognizable that it doesn't feel as frightening anymore.
I'm so fascinated by like these games like, you know, Fiasco, Tui, Lovecraft-esque, Tui, you know, For the Queen, all that, in that like it feels like a place where product design meets game design, like the like you're able to create the best version of the physical goodies that elicits the gameplay. When you're in the design room, I'm always curious about how you're thinking about, you know, I've got the box here for the listening audience, like how you're thinking about this box when you're in the design. Like what are the things that you get to put in here that change how mechanically players can engage with the game that you weren't able to put like in a book?
So obviously the key thing is, as I said, it's the cards with prompts on. So we found in the first edition, and we were surprised by this, perhaps because the kind of gamers we are, we are quite comfortable just sort of improvising anything at the table and we enjoy that style of play. But we found a lot of people really liked the scenarios that came with the game. So each of the scenarios had a specific character, a specific location, and a list of prompts. And you would look at the prompts and you would make up a clue based on one of those prompts. And we had some amazing scenarios in that game, and it's still worth buying the first edition to get those scenarios, in my view. But it's a bit like the Fiasco playset thing, you know, like the Fiasco playsets are full of information, and having them on a piece of paper, it's just not quite as accessible at the table as having them on cards so you can pass around the individual piece of information, and that's what the cards do. So in second edition we were able to create scenarios that were made up of cards, but also the core decks with sort of a generic, a kind of boring sounding word, but I'm going to say generic Eldritch horror prompts, and then of course the great thing about cards is you can mix and match them, so you can build your own stuff. The other thing about putting it in a box is we could put in things like pre-printed sheets for people to write down their clues. And we've got a board. So the original game came with a kind of printable, outable sheet that you could tick off boxes to say what stage of the game you're at. Now you move a little token around the board, as well as it looking very pretty, obviously. And I guess the other great thing, what I really am proud of with this box, it's turned out to be a really big box. Well, I think it's, I guess it depends what you're comparing it with, but it's a big box. And the reason for that, well, like the main reason, is that we've created a standing card library in the box. So once you've decellophaned the cards, you can stand them up in the little slots. So each individual scenario, you can just grab it and go. And that's kind of, it's a bit technical and it makes the box a lot bigger. But it means that, you know, it comes to Saturday night and you fancy playing a game, you can just open the box, grab each deck of cards that are already sorted for you, and away you go. So it's like super duper quick to play. It's a thing that I copied from the Dominion board game that I used to play a lot of back in the day. And I just really, it's such a nice practical thing.
We were talking about Dominion when we were prepping for the interview because I was just gushing to Brian about like, oh, it's a big box and it's so well organized, because there's nothing that will drive me nuts more than a poorly organized like board game box or role playing game box. And there's nothing that will get me more excited than a well organized like board game box. Like when everything has a place, you've got room for the expansions, which is also like one of my like personal delights whenever a game has room for their expansions in the core box. It's just, I just want to emphasize that effort is seen and appreciated for making that box so nicely usable.
Thank you.
Dominion is one of my all-time favorite games, partially because I love cleaning it up, because it has those individual like standing cards. So like cleaning up that game feels satisfying in a way. And also like, you know, just adding on to Elliot's point of being able to like add expansions to the box, that just, what I love about that is also what it says to the player, in that we're already planning for that. You know what I mean? Like there's a future already planned in the current box that you're holding, which is always fun.
And I know this is a massive tangent talking about Dominion, but I still play Dominion. And one of the great things about Dominion is that you can pull out four different Dominion boxes, and you can pull out the individual cards and mix and match them and make your own sets. And that was in my mind thinking about Lovecraft Esque, you know, the fact that you can say, oh, I'm going to take these cards from this deck. I want to use this scenario here and combine. I want to take the Roman scenario and combine it with the space scenario and do something really weird. You can do that. And that's just so much fun. It's like you get to be a little designer yourself.
Me and one of my roommates, when I first moved to New York, played Dominion all the time. And there's a slot in the Dominion box where it's just like one of every card. And you're supposed, like, an option you could do is like shuffle up and play random. But what we would do is we would lay them out and we'd draft. So like each person would pick one, and then you'd slowly build. You'd be like playing the game before you're even playing the game, because like based on my pick, type of card. It's really, and it's really fucking fun.
That's interesting. I've played it shuffle and deal random cards. It's only about 50-50 in terms of how it works.
Highly recommend the draft format.
That's
very cool.
That's fun. So I think it'd be good to get into kind of some of the mechanics and some of the like play experience of this game for listeners. Because two things are like, there's things that are true across this first edition and the second edition. The idea of creating an emergent mystery, the idea of focusing on kind of a singular main character. Can you talk a bit about the emergent mystery mechanics of Lovecraft-esque and how you were able to, like, how that maybe changed coming into second edition, if it changed?
Yeah, so emergent mystery, this is something that is kind of a white whale for me. I don't know if that's the right term because it sounds like I haven't caught it, but let's just go with it. what I really wanted to see, what we both really wanted to see, me and Becky at the table, was a game where nobody prepped the mystery, nobody knew in advance what was going to happen. But you didn't need to discuss it either, because it's a horror mystery, and horror, like, discussion is the enemy of horror, in my opinion. If you sit around the table and you're like, hey, I think it would be really cool if this happened, well, now you've just destroyed all sense of suspense. So that was what we were going for, is that feeling of a mystery that nobody knew. But without losing the coherence, because the important thing about a mystery is at the end, you should be able to look back and say, oh, it all makes sense. You should not be looking back and going, that was a lot of random stuff, and we kind of clutched it towards an ending. So the key mechanic for both first edition and second edition, I think Becky and I both think, is the leaping to conclusions mechanic. And that is basically, after each clue has been introduced, everybody around the table secretly writes down what they think is going on. So they look back on that clue, but also any clues that have happened before that. They write down what they think the bad guy is, or the monster, or whatever, and why they're doing what they're doing, and what they're up to, and where this is all going. You can start to think about, if nobody stops this, what's going to happen, right? So the very first clue comes out, and it's going to be something really probably quite small, because it's a slow building game. And it'll be like, oh, you find some weird looking fungus in the basement or whatever. And so now you're like looking at this piece of fungus and you're like, okay, I've got to come up with something. So you say, I know, there's a gigantic fungus entity living under my town, and it's going to start infecting people with its fungus spores and turning them into fungus zombies. And then everyone in the town is going to be replaced. And eventually it will spread out and the entire world will be nothing but fungus people. Cool. Someone else has a completely different idea, but we've all written it down secretly. And then their clue, it's their turn next. They're going to come up with a new clue, and I will have to adjust my theory to reflect that clue, right? So over time, your theory is adjusting and adjusting until by the end, you've got something that you probably couldn't have come up with at the start, which is completely rooted in the clues, which makes perfect sense looking back over the story so far. And anyone around the table is ready to create that ending. If somehow my fungus zombie story survives, then I'm ready to have all of my friends and neighbors show up at the end smiling, you know, dripping little bits of fungus out of their ears or whatever, and ready to do something horrific at the end.
One of the core things about this game that for anyone not familiar with Lovecraft-esque is that everyone at the table is playing as the same central character, or like are moving around the same central character rather than everyone having their own independent like player characters by like swapping these roles throughout play. Can you talk about how that works for anyone who's not familiar with Lovecraft-esque? Because it's a type of gameplay that people might not have experienced before if they haven't played something like Under the Autumn Strangely or something.
So yes, that's right. It's this is kind of because the classic Eldritch horror tale does not generally have a party of characters. There's a few exceptions, but generally speaking, it is one character who has stumbled upon something awful, and they don't have the tools at their disposal to deal with it, and they don't have anybody to help them. And it's much, much scarier as a result, because they're kind of, the deeper they get in, the more you realize they're completely screwed. They're going to have, it's going to end badly for them. There's no chance that they're going to be able to use their abilities because they don't have any. That's what we were trying to replicate here. We asked ourselves, well, how would you do that? And the only answer that made sense to us was, well, we're going to share the character. It's going to rotate around the group. And it's as simple as that, really. Every turn of the game, one person is going to be making up the clues and kind of performing a GM-like role, and one person is playing that main character. In order to make that work, you do have a bit at the start of the game where you kind of discuss the main character and make sure everybody is clear on who we're playing, so you don't get this kind of weird, janky, this is clearly being played by different people.
Hodgepodge of a person.
Yeah. But let's just say we're playing Kitty Delacroix, a curious journalist who's on holiday in Scotland. I know that she, you know, we've created a few details at the beginning, so I know that her personality trait is that she's very curious and she always wants to find out more about anything intriguing she comes up against. And we've decided that she's got a source of strength in the form of her locket that she was given by her mother that she clutches when times are tough. And we know those details about her, that she's on holiday, she's a journalist on holiday in Scotland. So I play her in a scene, and then I pass her over to you and you play her. And it's as simple as that. There are some mechanics in the game which help draw out the character's personality a bit and their inner monologue to help cement who the character is. So at the end of every scene, you do something called fears and rationalizations. And all that is the character or the player saying out loud what is frightening them right now and why they're telling themselves that it's going to be okay. And over the course of the game, you move from kind of the fears are small and the rationalizations are big and quite concrete and believable, to the fears getting bigger and the rationalizations increasingly feeling quite shaky. And you'll often do it in the form of something like a diary or a letter home. You'd be sort of, dear Aunt Matilda, I found this strange fungus in the basement. I really need to get somebody in to deal with that, because I am a little bit worried that the house may be getting damp or something, but no big deal. Through to, Aunt Matilda, I don't know if you're going to read this, but the neighbours are outside and there's something wrong with them, right? And so each, but by doing that, yeah, because a lot of horror, Eldritch horror is kind of, I stumble upon a clue, move on. The fears and rationalizations gets us inside the character's head a little bit more, which is quite helpful for that sharing of the character.
I really love, when I was looking through the rule book for this, one of the things that really jumped out at me is the creeping horror rule, because like, especially like cosmic horror has such a specific vibe to it that if you aren't already clued into that vibe, if you're not already clued into those like tropes, you might do something that kind of bucks up against what it wants to be and might kind of like fight the game. But on this rule, I'm just going to read it out because I really like it. On the creeping horror rule, it says, the horror must always be subject to doubt. Nothing supernatural or bizarre may be directly witnessed. Accounts of supernatural bizarre events must be from a source that can be dismissed. It must be possible to rationalize anything the witness sees. The main character may not admit the possibility of the supernatural. Which is like five quick things that at a glance kind of describe that entire genre and immediately give any player, either who's not familiar with the genre or not as familiar as some people, or any player who's not quite as quick to improvise things, a bunch of really great lines to draw within. And it's like, as long as you play within these lines, which are still pretty broad, still give you a lot of space to play, you're going to be telling the type of story that this game wants to play.
So a massive inspiration for this game was a book by Graham Walmsley called Stealing Cthulhu. And I highly recommend anybody who likes cosmic horror games, including kind of more traditional GM'd cosmic horror games, to read that book, because what it does is it analyzes Lovecraftian fiction, and it provides a sort of blueprint for running that style of fiction in a game like Call of Cthulhu. And one of the things it does is breaks down this idea of take it slow. You know, do not have Cthulhu show up in the first scene, because you will just break the genre entirely. And it breaks down those sorts of ideas about how to keep the horror at arm's length initially, so that it is deniable, and so that the character gets deeper and deeper into it before they realize, oh no, there really is something quite bad going on here. Now, the creeping horror rule is very much inspired by those thoughts in Stealing Cthulhu. The latest iteration, why those five things, I guess, is just a distillation of that plus 10 years of playing Lovecraft-esque, and just sort of, this is now our version of it. I don't know if I went back and reread Stealing Cthulhu if we've quite said exactly what Graham said, but there's definitely, you can draw a line between the two for sure.
It's interesting. Yeah, you mentioned that's something like you learned over 10 years of like having the first edition out, because it feels like a conversation we've been having a lot recently with designers. Like we had John Harper on, who talked about how Deep Cuts, the recent expansion to Blades in the Dark, is the lessons of that game being out for over a decade, and like playtesting through play of the released edition. Are there any other sort of lessons you've taken that show up in 2E from 10 years of playing 1E and hearing about people playing 1E?
I am pretty pleased with 1E in the sense that it kind of did a lot of what we wanted it to do. So if we have improved it, it's by sharpening things up. So I think, if I remember correctly, fears and rationalizations did not exist in first edition. You were just encouraged to kind of speak them out loud whenever you felt like it. And as a result, some people did it all the time, and some people just never did it. So we turned it into a formal stage because it's so important for getting into the character's head. It's the talk of the
table. Hey, this is Brian, and I just want to tell you about some cool new stuff from our friends at Hero Forge. Hero Forge offers fully customizable tabletop minis with dozens of fantasy species and thousands of parts to choose from, all within your web browser. Hero Forge is constantly releasing new content, and they've just launched their latest feature, custom acrylic keychains. These keychains use the same technology as their color standees and are the perfect way to rep your beloved character when you're out in the world. They are highly detailed, ridiculously durable, and made of 1/8-inch thick acrylic featuring front and back color printing, measured on the same 30mm scale as Hero Forge minis and standees, which means they will be a one-for-one match for your heroes on the battle map. Plus, Hero Forge just released stainless steel minis. These are perfect for anyone who is looking for the retro feel of old-school minis. These stainless steel minis have a textured finish and a rugged, highly durable feel. So visit heroforge.com to start designing your custom keychains and steel minis today.
You see, looking up from the ground, blood-red clouds boiling across the sky.
You did ask me to bring the thunder.
Dejin! Dejin! Help! I've got the chalice, please!
Well, if they're following you, then I guess that takes care of a loose end for me.
All of you feel the earth beneath you shake and crack and break.
I feel that I have failed both of you, and I am sorry for that.
This has nothing to do with you being a bad leader.
Do you want a countdown? Oh, I think I want a countdown.
I wanted to help. I always had good intention. I did not deserve to die.
Now.
The Lucky Die Podcast is a weekly 5e Dungeons & Dragons actual play podcast. Join our adventure every Monday wherever you download podcasts by searching for The Lucky Die.
Trenchcoat Raccoons is a fast, fail-forward TTRPG of chaotic heists, cartoon logic, and glorious disaster. Each player is one raccoon in a stack, all pretending to be a very suspicious human in a trench coat. Everyone rolls to help or hinder the main action, and every plan gets hilariously derailed by your raccoon's wild impulses. Steal cursed loot across a world of glam horror, glittering galas, mad science, and cryptid conspiracies. Think the slick heist energy of Sly Cooper, the camaraderie of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, and the paranormal absurdity of Gravity Falls, all jammed into one stack of disaster raccoons. Trenchcoat Raccoons is launching on GameFound in mid-October, and followers that back at the physical pledge tier level will get a free glow-in-the-dark raccoon D6 dice. So go right now to GameFound.com and search for Trenchcoat Raccoons.
Hi, my name is Robin.
And my name is Dylan.
Do you like Choices Matter video games?
If so, we started this podcast, Dorkspawn, so that I could show my best friend my favorite RPG series of all time, Dragon Age.
And now that I've played it, we want to share more of these choice-heavy games with each other.
Right now, Robin is showing me Mass Effect, which I have never played before.
And we are going to continue playing through these games together and discussing them book club style as we go.
You can join our Discord and play along with us, and tune into Dorkspawn every Friday wherever you listen to podcasts.
It's another thing that we've noticed recently in some of the interviews that we've done is a growing tendency that I really like in games to have these sections where they are very explicitly calling out either what the GM should be doing in order to make the game function at its best, or like how the GM should be thinking about the game, how the players should be actively doing and thinking about the game. And, you know, kind of in this scenario, what are elements of the tone and the world and this type of story? And by calling them out more explicitly than I've seen in games that are even just a couple years older, that might describe a setting very well, but don't have like these five bullet points of these are kind of the rules of the world. If you play within these lines, you're going to have a great time. Because there's another version of, you know, this rule book that has a very clear, a very poetic and prosy description of what a Lovecraft world is. But having these just like bullet points of do this is so incredibly helpful, whether it's for tone, whether it's for setting, whether it's for what a GM should do, whether it's what a player should do. It's great that people are starting to not leave that up to interpretation a little bit.
Yeah.
And just saying like, hey, if you need the TLDR, like if you need the too long didn't read, do this and you're going to get like 95% of the way there. And also here's a longer thing that explains, you know, setting and rules and whatever.
I think it's an underrated aspect of game design. I think as consumers, we tend to be excited by cool art and flowery description and a great concept. And maybe if we're lucky, some innovative mechanics, but just the sort of writing really clearly about how the game works. To me, that's an incredibly important aspect of game design. It's something I always strive for in my games, is to make it so that you can really understand what's at that core of that game, so that you can pick it up and run it like I would, and hopefully have the same great time that I've been having running it.
And I feel like it's crucially how the game works and also how it doesn't work, I think is like one of those just as important things to include, of just like, here are the limitations to put on your story, you know, here are the things to like focus in on, and here are the things to leave out. I think that like one of the things that I really love about first edition and second edition of Lovecraft Desk is the relationship the game has to the name Lovecraft. Like I like, obviously, it's right in the title, and it invokes this pretty shitty man. But like you and Becky also face that head on with like the way that I think on the second page of the rules, there's a paragraph about how H.P. Lovecraft was not a nice man. And here's like the things he did. But then it expands further and you have these essays, Lovecraft and Race and Lovecraft and Mental Health. So in terms of like the things, the relationship to that name Lovecraft, like, can you talk a bit about like including these bits of like, here's what you definitely shouldn't do with this game?
Yeah, absolutely. And for what it's worth, one of the reasons we call it Lovecraft-esque is to sort of say, you know, it's like Lovecraft, but it's not. You know, it's not Lovecraftian. Lovecraftian is a different thing. There are a lot of Lovecraftian games out there. This is not a Lovecraftian game. It's Lovecraft-esque. And that is because we are trying to capture the tone, the structure, and the kind of cosmic eldritch horror feel of a Lovecraftian story, while getting rid of a whole bunch of things actually, but let's talk about the race and mental health aspects of it. And really, it's just, I think if you were GMing the game, if it was like a Call of Cthulhu style game, it is a straightforward case of don't replicate certain tropes. Be aware of the tropes. That's what the essays are there for. They carefully set out what those tropes are and warn you about the pitfalls, you know, accidentally stumbling into replicating stuff. Things like using monsters as an allegory for racist theory. The way that sanity systems can take mental health and turn it into a bit of a kind of a joke, really. The kind of the gibbering madman, as opposed to, you know, actually people with mental health problems are real people, and at the bottom they are people, you know, that they may have, I mean, we, but most of us have some sort of mental health issue at some point. It doesn't turn you into a gibbering madman. So those essays kind of cut that up in detail and hopefully could be used for anybody running any kind of Lovecraftian game. But they were particularly relevant for Lovecraft-esque because with it being a GM-less game, it's easier to fall into those kinds of things. There isn't anybody, any one person at the table who can prevent it. So if I, as one of the players, decide to put in a clue that is kind of racist... You know, I've done that now, and there wasn't with a single GM. Like, if that GM's decided to do the horror at Red Hook or whatever, there's not a lot you can do to stop them. But with five players around the table, any one of them could potentially do that. So that is where all the kind of the safety tools and talking around the table and making sure everybody understands those issues becomes very important. To enable those sorts of things to be headed off before they happen.
Yeah, I think it's really well put in the book, in the text. I like that you point out, like, hey, if you free associate from Lovecraft, you're gonna fall into these traps. So, like, look out. There's a bear trap over there from these texts you love. I particularly, like, from my own design journey, want to call out that the Lovecraft and mental health bit that y'all wrote for the first edition was like a particular reference when I was designing a cosmic horror game, Project Echo, where there was a whole mechanic where I was going to put like time madness in as a thing that like characters could experience. And I read that essay and I was like, that's actually not a super fun thing to do. And so it became like a time dimension that they got pulled into that like it was a supernatural place. And the idea of like supernatural effects rather than some kind of nondescript madness, like really, really changed kind of how I was thinking about that, my own design. So yeah, just to really love that.
Cool. Thank you. I'm really delighted with it. We have got some stick over it. We've had some bad reviews that basically from people who didn't like that aspect of it, but I think it's super important. I know that there are some people who kind of feel like, come on, everybody knows Lovecraft was racist. You don't need to bang on about it. But it is really important, as you said, you know, if you free associate, if you're not careful, you will just end up doing it again for yourself, and nobody wants that. hopefully.
There's also an element of that. I know I've heard people say the same thing of like, everyone knows this. And that could be in relation to either Lovecraft or other like problematic figures in media that other media has been spawned from. And it's like, no, actually not everyone does know that. It's like, we're all assuming a level of like, there's like that XKCD comic that everyone assumes more competency and knowledge, like, or what is it?
Experts
assume more competency and knowledge about a niche thing than it could ever be realized. So like, you know, the TTRPG version of that is like two people talking and being like, oh, of course everyone knows about D&D and Pathfinder and probably like at least two Powered by the Apocalypse games and probably at least one For the Queen. And it's like, no, the average person doesn't even know D&D.
Like, right.
Like it is really worthwhile to have, even if, you know, the niche area that we're in thinks that everyone knows that. Ultimately, like you want this game and everyone wants their games to be played by larger audiences who may not have had, this might be their first experience with Lovecraft and they might not have that background. So no, I also agree. It's always worth having in there.
I mean, I think that about every game, actually. People kind of mock safety culture a bit sometimes, but the having a, not just a sort of generic set of safety tools, but actual thought and attention paid to what in this game is potentially going to cause somebody distress or make your game be less fun than it could be. You should, as a designer, that's what I want to see people doing, is just sort of calling out those specific things rather than just kind of going yada yada, next card, move on.
Yeah, the specific over the broad is always better in safety.
We also just had a conversation with Avery Alder, who did The Quiet Year and a number of other great games, and Monster Hearts, about safety tools. And one of the things that came from that conversation was the idea that, like, a lot of there is a group of people that think of safety tools as being limiting, as like you're taking away options from the table. And it's, you know, I'm sure there's some political things of like snowflake-esque or whatever. But in our conversation, it's like, no. Safety tools let you go way further. Because you kind of like, you have a chat beforehand, you say, hey, here are the areas we don't want to go to, or we want to make sure we're careful about going to. And because you have those kind of like signposts and flashing lights around like this area, that means, you know, the lines of lines and veils doesn't necessarily mean that stuff is off limits. It does mean that, but also it means let's talk about these lines so we can get as close to them as we can in a safe way. Like, safety tools are for the sickos. They're for people who want to get to the edges of what play can be. And by just negotiating that with a conversation beforehand, you can go to places that otherwise, if you approach them without care, would likely end the game early because people would be like, actually, I don't want to play this anymore.
Yeah, and I think they're a way of building trust. Like, if you repeatedly use them, you build a sense of trust because your group knows, A, that you've got this positive attitude of, I actually give a shit about your comfort and your fun, not just mine. And you build up a sense of your own boundaries much more quickly and more thoroughly than you otherwise would, so that you can come into games and right away be kind of zeroing right in on the stuff that makes everybody around the table excited. And that's what it's all about. I never title my safety section safety. It's always titled making the game fun for everyone, because that's what it's about for me, is like maximizing everybody's fun. And I think everyone should want that. I don't know why. Like, I can see why you'd be worried about safety. That sounds weird. It's like, what's going to happen to me? I'm in a role-playing game. You know, we just sat around the table making stuff up. But everyone should be wanting to have a fun time and to make sure all their friends have a fun time too.
And to have the funnest time, to have the maximum fun.
Apex fun, baby. Yeah, it's something like the trust building. I had a realization recently about the X card, which is a safety tool that, like you said, like sometimes people will use as like a I have checked the box of include safety tools in my game because I have put use the X card. And that is a problem. But I realized like the X card is a stronger safety tool when you've established trust through these other safety conversations. Like, I always use the X card at conventions because I'm like, hey, we don't know each other. Like, this is a ripcord kind of thing, just like because like we have limited time, we don't know each other. But the times in my life where I've used the X card or seen friends use the X card, it's with like so much trust that it is such a like comfortable, seamless part of play at that point where it's just like, oh, I'm gonna X that. And it's just like, oh, sorry, my bad. Like, all good. Like, do you want to talk about it? No? All right, cool. Like, it's just, it's the more you've had these other conversations, the more that like then when you slip, you know, like because we're, you know, we're making things up on the fly. Like if you do slip, like then things like the X card become more effective when you've had those more specific trust conversations.
Absolutely.
So it, like as we're sort of rounding the corner towards the end of this conversation, there's one more thing I want to talk about Lovecraft S2E, which is big, beautiful box I've got sitting next to me. How have you translated that for the digital play folks? Because I imagine that was like a unique challenge different from translating 1E maybe to digital.
Oh boy, yeah. No, it totally was. And I spent way more time than I perhaps expected to at the start of the project setting up a Roll20 playroom for the game. And obviously it means you don't get the big beautiful box. I'm sorry. But it's as close as you can get to a fully virtual version of the components of the game. Roll20 is not designed for doing this, so it was a challenge. But it is possible to make it do it. And I got some great advice from the folks at Bully Pulpit from their experiences doing Desperation. Is that the name of the game? It's a fantastic game from Bully Pulpit, and I've probably just forgotten.
Yeah, Desperation.
Great, 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 great. So yeah, I basically stole a lot of their ideas, so that like the boards can be seamlessly moved from one stage of the game to another, revealing all the new rules. Because one of the things we haven't talked about is one of the great things about the cards is it enables you to bring rules into and out of play during the game. So as you move from one stage to another, a new rule comes into play, an old rule is got rid of. So at the table, you do that by discarding a card and playing a new one. On the Roll20 setup, you just sort of click a button and it steps onto the next stage and some new cards appear and disappear. And all of the cards that you're using for your prompts and your character and so on are available to have in your hand. There's a version of the rule book that's all written into the journaling system. So it's, I mean, this is very, very boring. You cannot say in words what is really going on there, but all I can say is it's a very slick. I've had numerous compliments on it, and I don't really like Roll20 very much as an engine. So but I'm very proud of our Roll20 playroom. If you don't like Roll20, I can assure you this is better than the usual Roll20 experience.
Coming in hot for Roll20. I love it.
Sorry, guys, if anyone from Roll20 is listening.
I don't like Roll20 and I did it better.
Yes.
No, I respect it.
So you've put all the work into this great digital thing, but I do, before we leave Lovecraft Desk, want to just dip back to the physical, because there's some absolutely sicko shit cool production happening here. What is like the, I don't even want to tease it. Can you tell us the ultimate hidden goodie of when you own this physical box set?
Yeah. So actually, I'll talk a bit about first edition while I'm here, because when we did first edition, we really, really wanted every single illustration in the game to have something hidden in it that you don't notice straight away, and we worked with our artist Robin Scott to produce these images where you look at it and you're like, cool, this is a cool image, it's kind of creepy, and then you look for a bit longer and you're like, oh, that's something scary that I hadn't noticed before. I don't want to spoil the images in there, but it's another thing that's worth having that book for, is just those great images. In the second edition, we went a step further and we stole an idea from the Italian edition of Lovecraft Desk, which is to produce genuinely invisible art. And the game comes with a special UV throw blacklight flashlight, which you shine on the book, on the cover of the box, on the board. And every single page has got a hidden image in it, or a hidden detail. In a lot of the illustrations, you'll shine it on and an extra detail will appear that you couldn't see with the naked eye. So it's pretty sweet, if I do say so myself.
That's so cool.
It gets people very excited when they see it for the first time.
It's pretty rad.
Like I said, it's primo audio content, this. So you just have to go and find yourself a copy of the box to see it.
Is there any, and if this is a spoiler, feel free to tell me you can't answer, but is there any mechanical bits within this hidden stuff, or is it just like great fucking vibes?
I regret to say there is no mechanical implication whatsoever. We just couldn't figure out a way to do it. Well, no, it's just cool. Hopefully, oh, yeah, it gives you the vibes that make you more ready to play the game.
My favorite answer on this podcast is sometimes we'll ask a question of like, why did you make this thing? And anytime anyone answers, it was just cool. Yeah. I love that.
And it is because, I mean, I really have to give credit to the Italians here. They made the Italian version of the first edition of Lovecraft Desk. They created the classic white cover, and it's a completely pure white cover with a red sigil on the front. It just looks like nothing, and then you shine the torch on it, it's just covered in horrible stuff. And when you see it, you're just like, oh my God, that's so cool. And we had to have it. So we had it.
So before we get out of here, I want to, you have a Kickstarter coming up, and I'd love for you to tell us a little bit about it, about the game, and also what people can get in that Kickstarter.
Yeah, so this is, it's Ex Tenebris, and it is another emergent mystery game. So it's a gothic space investigation game. It's set in this expansive gothic setting, kind of like, you know how Lovecraft-esque is like, what if Lovecraft without the racism? Well, this is kind of what if Warhammer 40K without the Nazism, I guess, would be a really simple way to describe it. You are playing investigators from this hard-pressed government agency, Moira, and your job is to protect humanity from the demons that lurk in the Tenebrium, which is this dark other world that is the only way that spaceships can get from one star to another in a sensible period of time. To protect them from the ancient alien relics that have been left behind from countless civilizations before us, from cults, from sorcerers. You get the idea, the kind of that they protect you from the supernatural. And like Lovecraft-esque, it uses a emergent mystery engine. So you're GMing, you do have a GM, but the GM doesn't know quite what's going on until the end. The input from the players and from the GM's own ideas over time kind of warps and twists maybe their original ideas, and they end up with something unexpected. So, yeah, that's Ex Tenebris.
So you said that you're adding a GM. Are there other ways that this like new, what you're calling spawned from the Tenebrium system, which rips, is there other ways that that expands on the emergent mystery mechanics?
Yeah, I mean, I have to give some credit to the Gauntlet folks. So Ollie Jeffrey first created a set of mechanics which is based in part on Lovecraft-esque for doing GM'd emergent mystery in a PBTA style framework, I think. And then that was built on by Jason Cordova creating Brindlewood Bay and the like. So this game is very much inspired by some of that and then reincorporates ideas from Lovecraft-esque. So essentially, I guess the difference here is obviously if you've got a GM, you're not getting that thing where you go around the table and each person introduces a clue that can completely throw things, the cat among the pigeons. So instead, what the GM will do is in each scene, they're effectively kind of asking the players, what are you hoping to find here? Right. So they'll say, oh, I'm going to interview this witness, or I'm going to sneak into this place and look for clues. And the GM will listen to what the players are speculating about. There's a formal speculations phase. It's a bit like leaping to conclusions. But also, if they haven't really speculated, you might say, what are you hoping to find here? And then if you roll well, you're going to get what you expected to find. And if you roll badly, then you're going to get what the GM expected you to find instead. Right. So sometimes you will find things as the GM, you'll be forced to give the players a clue that you yourself would not have wanted to come up with because the players have rolled so well. And sometimes you will say to them, ha ha, you thought this was going on, but no, it's this. And that's kind of how the emergent mystery mechanic works in this game.
It again reminds me of our conversation with Avery Alder, Rehad recently, of like Avery and Benjamin Rosenbaum created Belonging Outside Belonging in Dream Askew, Dream Apart, which, you know, comes from PBTA. And then, you know, this whole world of Belonging Outside Belonging design came, and now Avery continues to design and now is informed by people that that were inspired by her work. So I love this, like, this full circle, the way that all of our, like, designs integrate and teach each other, and that you're building both on your own game from 10 years ago and on somebody that built something off your game. It's just, yeah, it's great.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I do love the indie community and the way that we're all kind of generating new ideas and feeding off each other. And yeah, it's a wonderful thing.
And then just for the details of the Kickstarter, when is it running? Where is it running? And what can people get if they back the project?
Yeah, so it is running from the 9th of September in this year, 2025, until I'm going to say the 9th of October. I'm not sure if that's right, but roughly a month. We are funding two fantastic books. We have a core book, which contains basically everything you need to play the game. It's got the vast majority of the setting and rule system. It's got a bunch of scenarios, because this is a scenario-based game, enough for you to run, at the very least, a short campaign, depending on how quickly you get through these things. And then there will also be the campaign book, which contains a heck of a lot more scenarios. We're commissioning a ton of amazing writers to produce scenarios for us. And like the Lovecraft Desk Kickstarter, we're not doing a stretch goal, so they'll be there guaranteed right from the start. We've got some fantastic writers doing that. So there's two books. It's illustrated by Juan Ochoa, who I think, if you've ever seen anything by him, you're probably excited by that. amazing art. And it's you will be able to get, if you're really into it, you'll be able to get this rather snazzy slipcase set. So two books inside a creepy, occulty looking slipcase with a fantastic campaign map included as well.
And we'll be sure to put all those links in the show notes. So just click on those links and check out that Kickstarter. Josh, before we get out of here, there's one last question that we always like to ask all of our guests, and that is, what are you bringing to the table? And this is just our way of asking, what is a recommendation you have for our audience? It could be inside tabletop, outside of tabletop. It could be a book. It could be a movie. It could be a person. It could be a place. Anything at all you'd want to recommend, what do you bring to the table?
Let me just go with the first thing that leapt to my mind. I mean, there's so many good games, and it feels horrible to have to pick one, but I am feeling a hankering to play again Apocalypse Keys by Ray Najardi. Is another emergent mystery game. It's got a whole bunch of cool ideas. You're kind of playing Hellboy. It styles itself as being like Hellboy. It's kind of weird demons hunting other demons and trying to save off the apocalypse. And I just really love it. We did a fantastic playthrough of it in our Actual Play podcast, Black Armada Tales. So if you like Actual Play and you'd like to know what that game is like, give it a listen. And in fact, I should also mention, on that self-same podcast, you can hear us play Lovecraft Desk. You can hear us play Ex Tenebris. So it's a good place to find out about indie games.
Thank you so much, Josh, for coming on to Talk of the Table. Do you want to let our audience know one more time where they can find you, where they can find Lovecraft-esque, and where they can find Ex Tenebris?
Yes. So our website is blackarmada.com. You can find me on Blue Sky as Armada Josh, all one word. I should also mention my other half, Becky, who is co-author of Lovecraft-esque, and she is on there as, I want to say, Becky Anderson. It might be Becky A or something like that. And Ex Tenebris is on Kickstarter. And I really regret giving it a name that's difficult to spell. I would suggest you check the show notes for the link to that, because that's just the best way.
And of course, as always, if you want more gaming content from us here at Talk of the Table, check out the Many Sided newsletter and join us on the Many Sided Media Discord, where you can chat about this and all our episodes. You can support Talk of the Table on the Many Sided Media Patreon, where you get special roundtables, bonus ad-free episodes, as well as some bonus actual plays for our podcast, My First Dungeon. That'll also be linked in the show notes. Please rate, review, and follow Talk of the Table wherever you get your podcasts. And that's what the table is talking about. Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye.